This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. And it is April, and it is Poetry Month, so at the bottom of the hour, I will be playing a poem read for us by Nicholas Guy Smith. And it is a John Keats poem, and I'm looking forward to sharing that with you. But right now, I get to turn to somebody who, well, he could take over the show. Because he is a positive person, and he is full of joy. And I am so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper someone who has written a book that, well, you know, when I read the title at first, I got it wrong. Because it's Never Say Whatever. And for me, it's like, I never say whatever. Never say whatever. How small decisions make a big difference. Richard A. Morant, welcome to Joy on Paper.
Hey, good morning. Great to be here.
Well,
or good afternoon. I'm sorry, good afternoon. I'm in California.
Well,
so
no, it's still 11. We're going to be here till noon. So, you know, when I was thinking about it, I thought, well, one of the things when I have, you know, people on and I'm talking about their books, I always, my biggest compliment to them will be, I will say, it is rich and it has depth. Well, that's how I can describe your book. Never Say Whatever. You know, it's not a novel. And sometimes people will think a business book is easier to write or, you know, there's less that goes into it. And boy, oh boy, that's not true. Because you've put all of your life experiences in this book and your observations. So it has such depth and it is rich for somebody named Rich.
Well, I know that there's a lot of books out there that are complex and everybody says, someday I'm going to read that book and it ends up on their night table. So I wanted to write a book that was easy to read, that was funny, that was prescriptive, and that would actually change some lives. I'm the evangelist for people to stop saying that word. I don't want people to say whatever because it's not good. It either means you're not making a decision or it means you're conveying a message that you're a slacker, that you don't want to make a decision. I'm too lazy to do that. So the simple message to all of your listeners is stop saying that one word and your life will be better.
That's true, because it is a word that's not in my vocabulary. I've never said it about anything.
Well,
I've been working since I was 7 years old. And for me, it's never say never, because I always would do something. I always would find something to do.
Well, that's you're unusual, because as I've talked about the book to others, everyone says, ugh, I should stop saying that word, or ugh, the guy who works to me next to me at the office and cracks his knuckles all day, he's the guy that I'm going to give this book to because he says whatever all the time and it drives me crazy. And the word has become like an earwig. I mean, since I've written the book, everybody's telling me, you know, I can't get rid of that word now. Every time I hear somebody say it or I say it, it's like a fingernail on a blackboard. It goes, ugh, I need to work on this and stop saying it.
Well, you're right. People use that word. And, you know, with this younger generation, now we're hearing it even more because the attitude about work and about life and about decision making, which is basically what you're talking about, being able to make decisions, sometimes you feel like the world is upside down.
It's true. Although I have found that you know, it's really easy to point to, especially, you know, younger women, teenage girls especially, who are always blamed with saying the word whatever. Remember that movie Clueless where Alicia Silverstone, she always, she would go, oh, whatever, and yeah, and would make a W with her fingers. But I found that everyone does it. Now, some people may not say the word. Some people may shrug their shoulders or roll their eyes. But, you know, I found that men, women, all generations say it. And I understand why. It's a simple, you know, we're all faced with so many decisions every day. But every time we say whatever, we're not making that decision. And I like to tell a story about some researchers at Cornell who figured out, this is what researchers do, that just in the act of going out to lunch, we make about 200 small decisions. And it's, you know, where to go, where to sit, whole wheat or sourdough, lettuce and tomato, mayo, mustard. You know, imagine all those questions. And every time we respond with a whatever, we're likely not to get the sandwich that we want. So it's a simple metaphor about how decisions, and whenever we don't make those even small decisions, we're likely to end up in a spot that we don't want to be in.
Exactly. That's why I always know what I want, and I go for it. And I make decisions. I take the risk, and I make the decision, even if other people around me think, what are you doing?
Well, there's something called the two-minute rule that applies to a lot of decision-making, and that is that the decision that you are likely to make in the first 2 minutes when you're faced with it is probably the same decision that you would make even if you suffered over it for the next week. And sounds like you're a good example of somebody who can make that quick decision, because the power of making a fast decision is that if you don't like it, you can always change it quickly. But if you suffer over something for a week with a big whatever, and then, you know, at the end of the week, sometimes it's too late to change your mind.
Yeah, it's true. And I made the decision to do Joy on Paper one morning at 4:15 a.m., and I made the decision in a few minutes. I listened to an interview on the radio. It was a very bad interview. It wasn't the kind of interview that I would want or that you'd want. It was just boring. And I said to myself, I could do better. And then 2 minutes later, I said, I'm going to have a radio program. It was as simple as that.
Yeah, good for you. Well, there's a good example that is live and current, because your listeners some of your listeners might say, well, I say that word all the time, but, you know, I don't like this program, whatever, and they turn it off. But instead, if they listen, they might learn something and change their lives.
That's right. You have to take risks.
I tell another story where I was at a ball game, baseball game, with one of my sons, and we've had a few beers, and his boss walked by, and in that split second, he had to make a decision. He could say, whatever, I don't want to introduce my dad to my boss, especially after these few beers. But instead, in the split second, he called her over, and she came over. She'd had a few beers too, and we had a great time, and it helped his career. And it was as simple as that split decision, and he never regretted that. And he laughs about that as an example, but there's millions of examples every day where we could say whatever. And, well, the first thing when you get out of bed in the morning, you could say, whatever, it's going to be a bad day, whatever. And no, make the decision that it's going to be a good day, and chances are better that it will be.
Exactly. When you were, you know, thinking about doing this book and knowing, you know, we're coming out of the pandemic and people are sort of, there's this vagueness about people that didn't exist really before the pandemic. People are unsure of themselves in many ways. And it is very important, but if they're going out now to get a job, a new job, realizing that, boy, oh boy, I want to be prepared in case there's another pandemic down the road, that my life is in good shape.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to be that kind of person who's going to say whatever. If you go for a job interview, it's not a whatever thing. You have to be able to make decisions and then make sure that the person interviewing you understands that you are a person who can make decisions.
Yeah, and there's so many examples, and the post-pandemic timing is that you mentioned is so good that way. There are all kinds of little tests every day that that tell us whether or not we have a whatever attitude. So, for example, since the pandemic, we all have Zoom meetings and video meetings, and the question often is, you know, whatever, I don't feel like getting dressed up for this meeting, or I'm going to just show up in my bedroom in my PJs. No, that's a whatever. Or should I prepare for this Zoom meeting? Yes, you should. You shouldn't say whatever about that. Or should I prepare for my performance review? Whatever, they know how I did. No, you need to prepare. And there's, based on all the interviews I did for the book, the one thing I learned that everybody has, people who don't say whatever, and it sounds like you're in this category, is they have an intention, and it makes it easier then to make decisions. So you had the intention that you were going to start a radio show. So all the decisions that followed were easy to make because your intent was to make a successful show. And I found that with leaders, they are very clear about their intentions, and in our personal lives, it can even apply. For example, I use the example, if your intention is to lose weight, you act like you're on a diet, and you make decisions that are like that, that will lead to not gaining weight. If you intend to stay married, you act like you are married, and you make decisions accordingly. And if your intention is to create a successful business, then your decisions are all about working hard and paying attention to costs and things like that. So all of the interviews that I had with so many successful people, everything from CEOs to people who had just happy and successful lives, one thing that was constant in everybody's attitude was they had some idea about what their intentions were, and then their decision-making process was so much easier and very clear. It was an aha moment.
Well, you're such a successful person. I mean, you are, you've been described as an influencer. Of course, you've done so many great things in Silicon Valley, venture capital. I think one of the words describe you as pundit, which I always think of as sort of that makes you sound like you're a Buddha sitting there, but yeah, with all wisdom. But it is that you've gone through a lot in your life. You know, your education was great, and then of course being a college professor. Now that was a challenge. That must have been a big challenge.
It was a big challenge. And that was being a college president was a big challenge because lots of times you have to make decisions that are not popular, and sometimes all the decisions that you have to choose from are not good. So you learn how to make the least unpopular decision, and I think leaders. And the CEOs and the real successful leaders that I spoke to, first they never say whatever. So I had to explain to them what the book was even about. But can you imagine Steve Jobs or so many successful leaders ever saying whatever? But I've learned that what the process that they use often is very simple. That they listen to people, they look at the data. And then what they do in their mind is they form options. There's not thousands of options. Often there's only just two or three. And then they make a decision based on the listening and the data, and they pick one of those two or three rather than, you know, suffer over them forever. It's a real... the book is about decision-making, but I want to make sure your readers understand that it's not complicated. There's no spreadsheets with pivot tables and flux capacitors in here. It's all about as simple as maybe listing pros and cons, or trusting your gut, or laying out all the options carefully. It's not complicated, and I want people to understand that, especially on the small decisions.
Exactly. It's a fun read. It's just you mix in the humor with this philosophy in just a lovely way, so it makes it for a really great read, which is why I said, you know, when you have this background, you have the depth within you. It just comes naturally when you're explaining things in your book, and I think it's really inspirational in, you know, for people to read it. They hear the stories about successful people, and then they see just how that simple word that they've been using can really be so harmful to their lives.
Yeah. I am. It is simple. I mean, the whole book is really just telling people that the word whatever can hurt their career. It can make their lives less satisfactory. It can lead to all kinds of problems. You know, imagine. I mean, here's a simple thing that happens almost every day somewhere in someone's house where someone says, "What do you want for dinner, honey?" And if the response is "whatever," you're telling the person who asked you that you may not care, or you may be saying that I'll have whatever you want, but it doesn't work well on either side. So say, "Well, Chinese sounds good, and if that doesn't work, then if you don't agree on that, then you can always get something else." But whatever is not the right answer. There's a quick comment. There's a restaurant in San Francisco called the House of Prime Rib. I love that restaurant because no one ever goes there with a whatever attitude. You go there because you've already made the decision you're going to have prime rib that night.
Exactly. I love that because I haven't been to Toronto for a long time, but there's also, there was a man who took over the warehouse district in Toronto, and in each warehouse, he built a restaurant, but they were for a specific thing. The steak warehouse was a steak warehouse. You had to have steak. And there was a seafood one.
Yeah.
It was so simple, and all you knew is you're going to have steak and baked potato and green beans, and it's going to be the best. Or if you're in the seafood one, you're going to have lobster or the freshest fish that they can get. And it was so simple, and it was always so crowded because people just loved going in there and just say, "Give it to me," you know?
Well, it was a smart marketing decision because he made the decisions for people. He didn't have to worry about people coming in and saying whatever. He made it easy for them, and I think we're all suffering from decision fatigue right now, and any way that people can make decisions easier for us, it helps.
You're right. And for you, your life is so interesting, and as an influencer now that you can go out there and meet people and talk to people, I hope that it's great that the pandemic's over so that you can get out there and meet with groups of people. And it would be nice, I think, also if you could meet at, since you were a university president, get into that network too and talk to them, because we have to learn to be decisive at a young age, because if you keep going on for years and years not making decisions, you really are going to get yourself in a muddle.
One of the things that I talk about, and I think we've all experienced this, that often all the big decisions in life come in a bundle. And the first bundle that all of us hit is the decisions that we have to make right after college. That is usually the time where we're making decisions about our career, our geography, where do we want to live, our family? Do we want to stay close or not? And it's often the case where that's the time also we're making big decisions about relationships, especially as it comes to that person that we've been dating for the last 2 years of college. What do we do about that relationship? And that bundle all happens all at once. And the decisions that you make at that time follow you through life. And so those are the kinds of decisions, those are all big decisions, and those require a lot of time and thinking and decision-making tools. And the more you learn how to do it even then, the more prepared you'll be for the rest of your life. But then they don't get any easier. Then all the decisions start coming about children and lots of other big decisions.
Well, graduation is coming. Graduation is coming up. And your book is a perfect gift for anybody graduating from high school or graduating from college. If parents, grandparents, and aunts and uncles out there are thinking, well, what should I give? In addition to giving some cash, which everybody likes, but give this book, because it's a kind of thing, as I said, it's a fun book to read. You have all of these sort of bullet point ideas, but also the human interest stories that I think young people particularly will relate to. So it is really a perfect graduation gift.
It is. And it's geared toward a younger generation. This is not for old people I don't mean to say old people don't make decisions or older people, but I think lots of times the decisions there are less important as they are when you're in your 20s, and the decisions that you make, are big ones that can affect your whole life.
Exactly. Well, if they should set up at all of the universities where they have, the parents come for graduation events, you really should get in your network of college presidents and get your books in a display in all of these colleges, because the parents are going to be coming and they will pick up this book and give it to their kids, and their kids will be grateful because they will learn an important lesson. Do not say whatever.
One thing that's so frustrating for me as an educator is that decision making is not taught in schools. So you can take calculus and trigonometry and all kinds of classes that you may or may not use for the rest of your life, but in high school or college, decision making is not taught, and it's that I think is a crime, because that is so important. Even the act of picking where do you go to college or should I go to graduate school, lots of times those decisions, and any parent who's taken their child on a college tour knows that sometimes those decisions are made based on the colors of the football team uniform or what what has the best Greek life, not based on anything that's going to be critical to the future of that student.
Yeah, well, I think your book is great. All of your books are great. I love the one Keep the Donuts. I always remember that one whenever it says keep the donuts.
Thanks. Cancel the meetings and keep the donuts, because that's all anybody cares about.
Yeah, that was a great book. Well, you have so many, but people, I just want to tell everyone they should get this book, Never Say Whatever, How Small Decisions Make a Big Difference. And Rich Moran, I think you've done a terrific job with this book, and I hope people will get it for graduations and other occasions. But it's a wonderful book, and people will learn a lot. And you're right, in school they don't teach you either how to make decisions or how to handle money. And then you get out in the world and you are a mess. So that's one of the things why you should have a paper route when you're 7 years old, because you learn how to make decisions and handle money.
You're right. What I don't think they have those anymore.
No, I know. I was so lucky. I was the first girl. So you see, I made a decision because no other girl in my little town had ever thought to be a paper boy. Well, I said, I can do it. I ride a bike better than these. And so that was a decision that really changed my life.
Yeah, that's right. And that may have seemed like a small decision, but there you are. You learned how to be an entrepreneur and how to be a leader and how to handle money and And the rest is history, as they say.
Exactly. Well, Rich, you have a website you want people to go to?
It's richardmoran.com. It's, the book is easy to find at all the usual places. And I hope that, you know, I've taken it upon myself to be the evangelist for not saying whatever. So I hope your readers or your listeners got something out of my talk this morning.
I think they did. Today. I think they will. And I'm going to make sure that I remind them all the time, because nobody ever says, would dare say whatever to me. Okay. Rich Moran, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. You are a joy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Okay. As I said, it's... Let's do the commercials, and I'll come back and I'll introduce the poem, okay? Oh, book buzz. Oh, yeah, let's get the book buzz.
Hey, everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Tock Clock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. Something I've been told in my life sometimes is the word no. No this, no that, no, no, no. Someone else who's had to endure the word no is the multi-award-winning singer, artist, actress, and icon, Mary J. Blige. Being told no has been one of the hard times she's had in her life. But now, Mary J. Blige has taken the no's and negativity and turned it into something positive that can be an inspiration for so many people. She took that negativity and turned it into a children's book called Mary Can, written by Mary J. Blige and illustrated by Ashley Corinne. Mary Can tells the story of young Mary, who's been told no to many things. No, she can't stay up past her bedtime. Or no, she can't have another cookie. No, she can't be an astronaut. No, she can't even be the president. The one thing Mary really wants to do is sing. And she's not gonna take no for an answer. Inspired by Mary J. Blige's own experiences of being told she can't do certain things, Mary J. Blige wants to inspire young readers to overcome the discouragement and negativity so their dreams can come true. The debut children's book from Mary J. Blige is a powerful tale of inspiration. If Mary can, then you can too. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
Okay. That was so nice, and boy, oh boy, that is a wonderful book, and talking about somebody who doesn't know the word whatever, it's Mary Blige, and I can tell you, it's a delightful book, and I'm so proud of Devon Miller for finding all of these wonderful books. Now, because is my guest on? Not yet? Okay, I'm just waiting for her to call in. So we're going to go ahead and play a poem, and I wanted to just give a little introduction to it. It is Poetry Month, and I am so thrilled that Nicholas Guy Smith, who is the narrator for one of my favorite books, The Gentleman from Moscow, is been so kind. He's recorded several poems for me for Poetry Month, and this one is a particular favorite, and it is called Song by John Keats. And the interesting thing about this poem is, listen to it. It's a short poem, this part of it. We're just playing part of it, but there's a lot of metaphors in it. It has depth, and it's just an example of what a beautiful poem can say in a few words. And so we'll go ahead and play that.
Song by John Keats. Where be you going, you Devon maid? And what have ye there in the basket? Ye tight little fairy, just fresh from the dairy, will ye give me some cream if I ask it? I love your hills and I love your dales, and I love your flocks a-bleating. But oh, on the heather to lie together, with both our hearts a-beating. I'll put your basket all safe in a nook. Your shawl I'll hang on a willow. And we will sigh in the daisy's eye and...
Oh, okay. That ended so quickly? Okay, something happened. There's a little bit more. Anyway, I was so thrilled that Nicholas Guy Smith has done these poems for me. And it's just such a thrill to hear his voice. As you heard, it's beautiful. It is music by itself. So now I want to go to my guest. And this is... really great because, you know, I love Kensington books, and I'm so thrilled when I get them. And all the covers are always so distinctive and so memorable. And then when I got the first time I got one of these books in this series, that I love books, as everybody knows, I love books in general. But when I got this series, it's called the Jane Wonderly series, and the book covers are fantastic. And I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper Erica Ruth Neuhauser, and thank you for joining me today, Erica.
Thank you so much for having me, Patsy.
Okay, well, this one is Intrigue in Istanbul, which is, I mean, the minute I got that, I thought, oh my gosh, I just, you know, I've been to Istanbul, I drove all through Turkey, I know the area, I love it, I loved my trip to Istanbul, it was part of my first honeymoon, and so I love that. But of course, I loved the one, I had to say this, and I didn't have you at the time because I don't know why they didn't send it to me. They should know when anything about Cairo I love. So the book one was set in Cairo.
Yes, sure was.
And that was Mina House, and that is a terrific book. And I just wanted to say, you know, that from the moment I read that book, I was hooked on you because you are so, so really fantastic. Your writing is great. And you would have to tell us about your character. It's set in the perfect time for me, 1926. And your writing is so evocative and takes me to all these places that I love. So tell us about this series.
You.
And this is book four now. So the new one is in Istanbul is book four, right?
Yes. Yes. So this is book four. Like you said, the first one is set in Egypt. It's at the Mina House Hotel, which is a real hotel. It's right next to the pyramids. The second one was Murder at Wedgefield Manor, and that was on an English country house. And the third one is Danger on the Atlantic, and that was on a transatlantic cruise.
Ooh, I like that one, too.
Yeah. This one's Istanbul. This one's a little bit different. It's more of an adventure story. The others were more closed-circle mysteries. But, yeah.
Well, and, of course, Kensington got into the... right into the story. They have this wonderful way of capturing a story in a cover.
They do. I really like my covers. I think they've done a fantastic job.
They're like works of art.
These last two. Yeah, these last two have been really beautiful, especially.
So tell us all about Jane. I love that Jane is one of my favorite names because I just love Jane Eyre, so I love that. And then, of course, the period that you picked is such a perfect time for lots of intrigue. Everything is a sort of in between the two big wars.
Yeah. So Jane Wonderly is a widow of the First World War. She's not exactly sad about it. She has kind of a little bit of a dark backstory. But she, in the first book, she's traveling with her Aunt Millie, and that's why they go to Egypt. And then after that, I have her going from place to place, which is, you know, an excuse for me to get to travel.
Sure.
And
it's tax deductible.
Sure is. And let's see.
So,
what else to say about Jane? Well, oh, the 20s. I pitched the 20s. So my dad raised me on old black and white movies and, you know, Masterpiece Mystery and Agatha Christie. So I just knew that when I wrote my first book, like, I knew exactly what I wanted it to be like. I had this very strong mental picture of, you know, like a very elegant hotel in Egypt and the slow fans moving overhead and everyone, you know, elegantly dressed and then there's a body in the corner. And I picked that up somewhere along the way, all those old black and white movies that my dad had me watching. So there was no doubt that I wanted to set it then. But I also, like, I really like the 20s, not only because it is a really evocative time. I think when readers hear 1920s, they immediately picture, you know, flappers and cocktails and speakeasies. But it was also a really interesting time socially. So I can do a little bit more with Jane. She can push a little bit of the boundaries a little bit more just because of the time period.
And we get, as the reader, we also get to travel in style, and
yeah,
which is always fun. And,
absolutely.
And of course, you, for each book, you're doing research into the history of the place you're going to, and like, I was happy that you used the Mina Hotel because everybody always used Shepherd's, but I think the Mina is so fascinating.
It is. It's such an interesting hotel. And the reason I picked it is because, I mean, now Giza and everything, like, has built right up to the pyramids. You can eat at a restaurant right across the street. But back then, the Mina House was the only thing out there, and you really had to get transportation to get out there. So it kind of gave me an Agatha Christie-esque way of having, like, all my suspects in one place. And it is such a cool hotel.
Well, it was really built for VIPs who were coming down to look at the pyramids, to explore all the British and the Germans, too. There were a lot of Germans coming down, French coming down, and everybody was all wild about finding new pyramids, and they needed some VIP accommodations, and they got it.
Yeah, they sure did.
So now with the new story, we, of course, now we get a little bit involved with some, tell us about the premise here for the mystery about Sultan Suleiman.
So in this book, Jane and her love interest, Redvers, they go to Boston. They're hoping to introduce Redvers to her father. But when they get there, they find that her father has taken out a huge loan against the house and disappeared to Istanbul. So, of course, they want the money back so they don't lose the house. So they take off to Istanbul. And when they get there, they realize that her dad has maybe found a little bit of trouble, but he's looking for the Sultan's heart. Now, that's a real artifact that I learned about watching the Discovery Channel. And I was like, oh, this is such an interesting story and something I could absolutely use. They still haven't found it to this day. Sultan Suleiman, back I think in the 1400s, died on the battlefield. And his viziers didn't want anyone to know that he had died until his son could get there. So to keep up morale for the soldiers, they kind of pretended that he wasn't dead. But they took out all his organs and they buried them there on the battlefield. And like later his body was taken back to Istanbul, but his like heart and the other organs were never recovered. And even today they're still digging for them. Last I heard they were digging under a winery thinking that they'd finally figured out where they might be buried.
Like Jimmy Hoffa.
Jimmy Hoffa.
Keep digging around.
Yep.
So yeah, no, it's a lovely story. I think you have this ability. Obviously, you do research, you try to get really into the storyline. And I'm sure while you're writing it, you're living it.
Yeah, I really am. It's one of the reasons I like to pick fun locations so that I get to spend, you know, a year researching and then traveling to some place that's really fun and interesting for me, since I have to spend a year with the location.
So, with Istanbul, tell us about your trip to Istanbul.
Oh, it was lovely. It was actually quite last minute. The way I write is I write the book, and then I figure out what I need to learn about or what I need to see, so that when I go on a trip, I have a very detailed list of the things that I need to research in person. And so I knew I needed to go to Istanbul, and it was honestly right after Russia attacked the Ukraine. I know, and it was like maybe 2 or 3 weeks after, and my ex-husband and I decided, well, I gotta go, and he was like, well, we should go now, so that before it gets any worse, or whatever happens over there doesn't get any closer. So we did. We did a last-minute trip. It was like a week later, and we just flew over for a long weekend. I wish I could see the rest of Turkey. It looks wonderful. I've heard really good things about like the countryside, and but Istanbul is such a cool city. It's definitely a city that I needed to see. There was a lot of revising that I did when I got back. I didn't realize like the terrain of the city is really hilly. It's almost like San Francisco in some parts, just like huge hills up and down. And I think like a lot of the architecture, the big mosques and all that is much closer together than I had envisioned.
When it used to be Constantinople, it was much smaller.
Yeah. Man, that song was in my head the whole time I wrote this book.
Well, it is beautiful. Those areas where you go into the old part of to the bazaar area. Oh wow, it's fantastic!
It's so overwhelming. The bazaar, it's so enormous. I had no idea.
It is. People don't expect it, and it is enormous, and it's absolutely so much fun. I loved it, and of course, to see the Blue Mosque and the cisterns and all that. It's pretty great.
It is. It's really remarkable.
And it's a very doable trip for a reasonable. As a matter of fact, I understand it's becoming sort of the new place people are going for plastic surgery to Istanbul.
So,
it's a hot place now since people are not going south of the border, because they have excellent doctors there. So so maybe more people will go there. But definitely, if they read your book, they'll want to go there because they'll want to know more and see more. And you're right. Your next trip, you have to go outside. I went to, of course, the other places. I went to Ankara, where I was in the middle of a riot. That was fun. But I luckily there was an American Marine who saved my life, and that's why to this day I love American Marines. But it those were tumultuous days in that time. But it's fun. I love the writing. I think your background from the point of view of the books that have influenced you. Of course, we naturally know Agatha Christie influences everybody. Did you like Dorothy Sayers? Who else influenced your writing?
Honestly, there was a lot of contemporary writers that influenced my writing. I remember exactly where I was when I decided that I wanted to write this series. I was sitting on my back porch with my best friend, who's a librarian. She was reading something, and I was reading Murder at the Brightwell by Ashley Weaver. And I kept putting it down and saying, I want to write something like this someday. I loved her characters. They were really interesting. I loved how she set it up. But I knew I wanted to do it in the 20s in Egypt. Growing up, I read a lot of Elizabeth Peters, the Body Theory.
Yes, that's one of my favorite series.
Same, I really loved those. Who else? I mean, I read a lot of historical fiction before I sat down to write myself. The classics, Sayers, and I read all of Nero Wolfe, to be honest. They weren't necessarily an inspiration, but that's my favorite historical series.
Oh, I love Nero Wolfe. I'm watching it in Italian television.
Really?
They have a series in. They've done the Nero Wolfe where Nero Wolfe goes to Rome, and it's
really?
And the series is in Italian. It is so wonderful. It is brilliant.
Oh.
And the Nero Wolfe, that is Nero Wolfe, the actor in that one. You can get it on, you know, streaming video, and you have to look for Nero Wolfe. And it's in Italian, but you forget it's in Italian because it's almost like you know the stories, and the actor is just so superb.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so excited. I did not know.
You have to find it. You will love it. If you love Nero Wolfe, you'll love that series. And I've been binging on that lately because it's just so much fun. So, yeah, that's he's good. That's a good influence. So, yeah. So where are we taking the next trip to?
So Jane is going to Scotland next, the Isle of Iona, and that one is based on a real case that happened there in the 1920s. A young woman died under very mysterious circumstances on that island, and so I kind of used that as some inspiration for this story. And then I'm contracted through book six. And I'm not 100% sure where six is going to be yet. I'm leaning towards somewhere maybe like India.
Oh, 1926 in India. Oh, you're going to...
I know.
I can't remember. Was it 1926 that Churchill was there?
Oh.
You have to check when Churchill was there. Yeah, they might be crossing paths around that time. Yeah, because he was there, and that's a perfect time to be in India. I love that period.
Right?
I love it.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's the fun thing about this, being a writer, right? You can go where you want to go, and you can take it off your taxes, because it's research. Yep. It's real research, and you have something to prove for it. A great book.
Yeah, I do.
And I know that you are, you know, just... I think when I've talked to people about you, they say, "Oh my goodness, she's such a great writer." And I like that when people recognize you now and they know that your writing is so good and you're getting getting famous. You're going to get really famous here, which is nice.
And I'm
really happy when I should have been interviewing you. This book came out on my birthday. I was so happy.
Oh, happy birthday!
And and meanwhile, you know, they've been sending me your books because, I'm just so happy with always with everything I get from Kensington. So again,
they do a great job.
They do, and you've done a great job with this book. I'm sure they're very, very happy with you. And we're gonna go on from India, but that would be a great place to go. Wonderful trips you're going to be making here.
I know.
This is cool.
Fun.
Okay. So do you have a website you want people to go to?
Sure. It's just my name, ericaruthneubauer.com.
And
they can find me.
They can find you, and they can find all of your books there, all four of them. They can start with this one, and once they get into it, they're going to want to know what else is happening to Jane. You've got a lot of interesting characters around her, and I always like when they have an aunt in there. And so,
good old Aunt Millie.
Yeah, it's always nice. So it's like Carol J. Perry has her Aunt Ibby in her series for Kensington. The Witch City Mysteries, and I get a kick out of it because I had a great aunt who was wonderful like that, and let's just say she was an interesting character. My aunt was a little bit more like your aunt, little bit of a a tippler a little bit.
Aunt Millie's actually based on my grandma, who was a little bit of a tippler and a little bit of a... She liked to stir up trouble, my grandma.
Yeah. Well, isn't it wonderful how everybody in your life becomes fodder for your work?
They do.
And who did you dedicate this book to?
This book was dedicated to Zoe Quinton, who is my freelance editor that I work with. I've worked with her on all of my books. And also some dear friends, Katie and Trevor Meyer. They, Katie I went to high school with, and I'm still very good friends with her and her husband.
Well, they deserve recognition, and especially your editor, because she's doing a good job with you.
Thank you. Yes, we work together really well.
I can see that. And it's a wonderful book. It really, everybody get this book.
Oh, thank you.
I know one thing, Mother's Day is coming up too, so get this book for yourself, and then you can get the whole series for your mother. Don't just give her one book. Give her four books.
Right.
Give her the whole series because, you know, this is, the fun thing is you are traveling in style to interesting places because Erica is a great writer.
Ah, thank you, Patsy. Very kind of you.
Okay, well, it's been a joy to talk to you, and I'm looking forward to the Scotland one because I love Scotland.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, she's so cute. And the book is delightful, absolutely delightful. Oh, what a wonderful trip I had to when we were in Turkey, and I should have mentioned to her, for anybody who has been to Turkey, if you remember this place, contact me. We were driving in Turkey. It was late at night. It was raining. It was torrential rain. And suddenly we pulled over and we saw some lights because we were in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of nowhere in Turkey, between Istanbul, between Ankara. And we pulled it, and there is a building, and it was the Ponderosa. I mean, it was the Ponderosa from Gunsmoke. We pulled in. As we pulled in, I looked at my husband, and he looked at me, and he was like, have we sort of gone through a twilight zone? You know, we've been through torrential rain. And we pull in, and there in front of us was the Ponderosa. We were so shocked. So we got out, we walked in, and there were lights or neon lights outside, and inside it was the Ponderosa. And it was a restaurant, and in the back there were cabins, log cabins. Everything was made out of logs. And it turned out that the owner of this place had lived out west, and then he had watched, you know, Bonanza, just love Bonanza. And he built that. Can you imagine? In the middle of nowhere. If anybody's been there, you have to contact me. Because I'd love to hear what you thought about it. And it wasn't my imagination. Anyway, remember what I always tell everyone. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book or to hear those, well, what else? Hear those magic words. Lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry. Okay, and I have to say something good today, something nice, and I will say something nice to Big Ed today because he controlled everything. We got the poem in, we got the book buzz in. Thank you, Big Ed, and everybody say something nice to somebody else today. Bye-bye now.